From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in a research lab in the 1950s with some pigeons. Harvard psychology researcher B.F. Skinner was studying pigeons to learn about addiction. He put the pigeons in boxes and trained them to earn food by pecking at plexiglass. Sometimes the birds earned food every time they pecked, but in other cases, Skinner set intervals between those rewards. The pigeons never mastered that timing, and as Skinner learned, the birds went nuts. One pigeon pecked the glass 2.5 times per second for 16 hours. Well, this study was conducted decades before the first smartphone was ever a thought, but experts say there are parallels between the behavior of the pigeons and the behavior of smartphone users. Like the pigeons, people who use the web or social media never know when we'll come across those rewards, but that doesn't stop us from trying. And as we search through news feeds, our brains experience surges of dopamine, a neurochemical associated with the feeling of anticipation, while a growing number of people don't want to have that feeling anymore. So they've decided to make the switch from smartphones to so-called dumb phones, phones that don't have any connection to the internet. They say it makes more sense for their mental health, for financial reasons, and for security reasons. Tech companies are releasing new dumb phones, and we're wondering, is this just a fad, or will the dumb phone make a comeback? Our guest this hour discussed that question and more. Joining me in studio is Mike Johansson, Senior Lecturer of Communication at RIT and Social Media Consultant with Fixitology. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Mike, you had a concern about the term dumb phone. Before we get too far, we don't want to be condescending toward the dumb phone. Yeah. What would you like to call the dumb phone?
Just a featureless phone, I suppose, as opposed to the feature phone, which is what smartphones used to be called.
Okay, so this conversation is now about featureless phones and feature phones. Also joining me in studio, Dr. Eric Kane. He's the former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester. Thank you for being here.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Mark Sample is here. He's a professor of history at MCC and a self-identified dumb phone or featureless phone user. Welcome to you.
Happy to be here.
And also joining me is Caitlin White, my colleague and a reporter and host of Weekend Edition here at WXXI. Welcome to you, Caitlin.
It's fun to be on this side.
Is this your first Connections appearance?
Yeah, on this side of the mic, yeah.
Good. Well, Evan and I had been talking about doing a show about the return of the dumb phone for a while now. We were waiting for a good news hook. And the news hook actually came from you, Caitlin, because you were going through this process yourself. You're deciding whether or not to make the switch. Tell me about what inspired you to consider going back to a flip phone.
Yeah, I have been, I guess, consciously thinking about my relationship with my smartphone. I have an iPhone 5, which I guess is dumb to some people at this point because it's kind of a couple years back. But I noticed, you know, grabbing my iPhone for Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, putting it down, picking that buck up, refreshing it and realizing that, like, no time has gone by. I've seen all the things that have happened up until that point. And just spending a lot of time, you know, watching TV while being on my phone when I'm with friends, when I'm driving, I'm not going to lie, but just all the time. And it started to get me wondering, is this something I really need? And I started talking to people around me, people who have phones, people who have gone back to phones, and kind of thought that would be an interesting story.
So where are you right now?
So
right now, have you made your decision?
No, I have not. I'm still... I don't know. We'll see. But maybe the end of this hour will help me. But so I have an iPhone 5, and I am not on Facebook in general. I'm not on Instagram in general, so I don't have those apps on my phone. Twitter is the only social media I keep. I try to keep my phone on no data mode, so I can only get texts or do things on Wi-Fi. And oh, I blocked Facebook and Twitter, so even if I have the urge to go to it won't let me. So that's the way I control myself at this point.
So you're one of a growing number of people that are contemplating those choices. Mike, what would you ever, I think I know the answer, but for the sake of being equal here, would you ever consider giving up your smartphone?
Well, I have, actually.
Oh.
And this is something that I talk to students about too, saying if you suspect you have a problem, maybe just try, go a whole day without picking up your smartphone. Just and tell people ahead of time, you want to reach me? Call me on the house line. Or say, you can only call me. The only thing I'm going to do on my phone is answer if it actually rings with a call. And if that goes well or doesn't go well, maybe extend it to a week. I've done this several times, actually, and oftentimes in summer when I'm not teaching a class and not having to, like, check email when I'm away from campus. But I actually find it really enlightening, and it really opens up your eyes to how much of real life you're missing if you're spending perhaps a little too much time in that virtual world.
So what's the longest you've gone without the feature capabilities of the smartphone, the
internet? Well, before I got a feature phone, but since then, which I think has been about 7 or 8 years now, probably a couple of weeks.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, after the first day, I truly do not miss it. I just understand that I'm now getting my news from NPR, from the newspaper. I am checking email on the home computer in the evening or in the morning, and I'm answering the phone. But outside of that, I'm actually spending more time with real people.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kane, what about you? Would you ever consider giving up your smartphone?
Sure. I confess, perhaps it's age and generational, but I grew up without one of these tools in my pocket. And so there are many a day where, you know, I'll look at the internet in the morning and then go through the day and see if there's email in the evening and that sort of thing. Now, I needed to be connected for many years because of my job, but, you know, my job doesn't demand that anymore, or the job I have now doesn't demand that. So, and I never signed up for Facebook, and I never signed up for a bunch of social media. And of course, maybe this gets to the generational part. I grew up in an era of what we might call valued privacy. And so the notion that I was an open book is really something that's a little bit different. Although I'm always open with people. So, you know, I don't mind if people, you know, go to a website or Google my name or things of that sort. But it isn't that I'm see that as the center post of my life.
So according to Pew Research, 95% of Americans have cell phones. 77% of those Americans use smartphones, and that's up from 35% in 2011. And among those 18% who do not own a smartphone is Mark Sample. Mm-hmm. And Mark, you are new to the cell phone world, from what I understand. Is this the first year you've had a cell phone? How long have you had a phone?
I had no desire to get a cell phone at all. Five years ago, I bought a Chevy car. I'm sorry to put product placement in here. But it had, if you know what OnStar is, so that had like a phone in the car, and you just push the button. And even though I didn't buy the car or care, having it in there, you know what I mean? If I was driving around and had to call my wife for something or whatever, I'd certainly use it, make use of it. And then when I got rid of that car, you'd kind of grown used to having that. Of course, as my wife likes to tell me, I'm the worst driver in the world. And you know, I haven't caused any major accidents yet. But I thought, well, you know what? If I've got this car now without it, I'll buy, you know, I went to Walmart and bought what was called a track phone, you know, and I thought, well, I'll just keep it in my glove compartment that I have to make an emergency call or have to call my wife or something. Of course, when I told people that I bought a track phone, people said to me, well, you know, Mark, you know, that's usually really like a drug dealer's phone. And I was like, I go, yeah, I'm 56 years old. Like, what drugs am I selling out of my trunk? Viagra? So anyway, I don't ever use it. It sits in my glove compartment, and once in a while I might have to make a call on it. I've never had to make the emergency call for a tow truck. So I guess it's there for peace of mind, but I don't care, and I don't really want. I certainly, God knows, would never want one I carry with me.
What would it take for you to buy a smartphone?
Nothing.
Nothing
it
at all?
It never happen. No, listen, as I say, I'm 56. I'm a college professor. I work, you know, jobs, children. I had a special needs child. I never saw the need for a phone. You know, I could always be near a phone if I had to call home, or, you know, use someone's cell phone if I had to make an emergency call. But the idea that I want one attached to my hip or a smart one, I can't even conceive it.
Okay, listeners, I'm seeing the phone starting to ring. We want to hear your stories about whether or not you've considered switching from a smartphone to a featureless phone. And we're wondering, is this just a trend, or will this continue, and will we see some of these percentages of smartphone numbers drop? And I'll turn that question to Mike Johansson. Is this a fad? Do you think this love of the quote-unquote dumb phone is a trendy thing right now, or do you think this is really, we're moving backwards in a good way for some people?
If I had to give you an educated guess, I would say the trend towards more people using featureless phones would actually increase. And I think it's like a lot of things. There's the bright, shiny new object thing. So this happens with every new social media network that comes along. Very few of them actually stick. There's a bright, shiny object for a little while, there's a big bubble, and then it goes down. It's the same with tech. You know, we see people going back, for example, to actual record players because they like the sound of a record player as opposed to the very crisp, clean digital sound. So I honestly do think more people will buy them. I mean, I can see myself at some point going to a phone that basically just you call people on or you text people on. Is it going to be a huge trend? I don't know. I think it's probably more, as they say, boutique niche, you know, like the record players, like cassette players. I mean, I actually saw somewhere online someone wanting to sell their cassette tapes, and someone offered them an inordinate amount of money for the whole lot, lock, stock, and barrel. They wanted them, which surprised me. So, yeah, I think it's definitely going to increase.
I've got a Candlestick phone in my house that could work if I hooked it up, and I bought it in an antique store. It was not cheap, but hey, maybe someday we'll be seeing featureless phones in antique stores, but maybe not if Mike's right. According to the Today Show, they did a survey in March when they were discussing a new product by a Brooklyn-based startup called Lite. So they did a quick survey. They said, would you ever consider switching your smartphone for a featureless phone? 75% of the people surveyed said they would never give up their smartphone, so only 25% saying yes. And in reference to this particular company and the phone they were offering, the Lite phone, the first version of the Lite phone. Have any of you heard about this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Caitlin, tell us about the Lite phone.
I mean, aside from being aesthetically pleasing, it's super sleek and it doesn't have a lot going on. But I think it just calls, texts, has the time maybe. That's something that is very attractive to me, because that's kind of all I want to do. I don't want to have the option to download apps anymore because I've gotten to this point where I can't control myself. So yeah, I've seen that phone. It looks great. It's on like Kickstarter, I think, now.
Yeah, yeah. So you're talking about the Lite Phone 2, which is an improvement from the original Lite Phone, which you could only store 9 contacts. It did not have an alarm. You couldn't text, so it was just calls and one other basic feature. But the Lite Phone 2, people complained. They said, we need an alarm, we need to be able to text, we need to store contacts. So the Lite Phone 2, which you just described, has all of those things. And the company is describing it as a phone for humans and a device that actually respects you. So that's the Lite. Another popular one came out in February of last year from Nokia. And it was an updated edition of the 3310 featureless phone that was popular in the early 2000s. So another one coming back. And then recently Samsung created the Galaxy J2 Pro, and it's a smartphone that cannot connect to the internet. So I'm not entirely sure what that means. Maybe Mike, you can help me out. But the company says it was designed for students so they can focus more on their studies. So what's a smartphone that can't connect to the
internet? Truthfully, I don't know, but I'm guessing it only allows you to do Wi-Fi and possibly only under certain circumstances. In other words, it'll allow you to connect to Wi-Fi at home, but not while you're at school, that kind of thing.
That's what I have. So I share 256 megabytes of data with 5 people, which means I never have data.
Same.
Yeah, it's hard.
Well, you know, but I think you're bringing up the point that a lot of people don't want to disconnect. So for a number of people, you know, this is a very, very important, you know, tether. And, you know, the idea, though, of changing the phone is like saying you're going to go on a diet and make sure you don't buy certain food. You know, that if you can't get access to it, then you won't be tempted. On the other hand, you know, there's some people, I think, probably regulate it pretty well. And so I'd be interested in what makes it so hard to regulate, which is part of what Caitlin was talking about.
I mean, I think I've had a phone for about 5 years, and being so connected to, you know, I've had Facebook since I was in high school. I've grown up with it almost, having all these connections and these sharing and things like that. So I think it's something that almost like affected my development. Like my brain thinks of posting things when I'm out at events and stuff like that. And when I started to think of that more, it made me a little nervous that I was like, oh, I just want to be at this thing. I don't want to think about what I'm going to tell people later about this thing. And I think that is where I had to go to the extreme and just cut it all out for myself, because I haven't found that regulation yet.
But that also raises the question, who's in charge of creating boundaries? Mm-hmm. So do we need to be better at self-control? Or should we put more onus on tech companies to create apps like Screen Time that Apple's just developing that will be released in the fall that allows you to limit how much exposure you have to certain apps? Dr. Kane, what do you think, as looking at this from the mental health perspective?
Well, you know, look, from the mental health point of view, this is a double-edged sword. You know, there are ways in which people can connect to others, can grow friendships, can become part of communities, sometimes very widespread, far apart communities. This is their major connection to the internet and that sort of thing. On the other hand, you know, there's tremendous amount of bullying that goes over social media, tremendous amount of pain that can be inflicted quite quickly and easily from afar. It seems often that people are more willing to inflict pain when they're not face to face. So I think that there, you know, this is really a powerful medium or set of media, and how people choose to use it is really critical. And I think this point of choice and really thinking about how we decide to carry out our lives, which is really, really what you were talking about, Tom, which is the notion. And, you know, both of you have said, I'm pointing to the male guests here. the idea that you've made decisions about how you want to lead your life and whether a tool like this fits is really, I think, critical for all of us.
Do you think we realize how distractive we may have become by our phones, or is it so ingrained in our lives that we're not taking a step back like Caitlin has? And
well,
and
we never had a chance to do a randomized controlled trial. I'm making a joke here of, you know, distributing phones, because I think a lot of us were distracted before. You know, people tend to be fidgety and get up and down and hard to focus. And I think it's really challenging for some people. And this was a great way focus your distraction. I'm kind of playing with that. But it's really clear that it's, for some people, a very, very destructive tool. And I think that's the part which you know, raises a lot of concern. And I'm not talking about addiction to it. I'm talking about just the idea that, you know, this is not a reward system. It's just a tool.
Yeah. So I'd be really interested in knowing. And I get students telling me this all the time, that they have friends, it's never them, it's always a friend, who cannot exist without posting on social media. In other words, an event didn't happen if it wasn't posted on Instagram and Facebook. In other words, it's like it didn't happen. You know, you can't begin an event or end an event without a picture that's going to be posted. You can't. And I sort of say, well, you know, what? How do you feel about that? And they say, well, it kind of seems almost normal these days. So I'm curious how you think this is.
Well, I think that this is really one of the things when you describe culture, this is really a part of some people's culture, that they define the things they do, the traditions they follow, the activities and the meaning they give to it, especially the meaning they give to it by, in terms of that they have to take a picture of the food they eat before they start. You know, traveling through China, I have a friend who takes all pictures of all our food, you know, as we go to China fairly regularly, you know, and, well, I know what you had for dinner tonight. You know, to me, that's, you know, it's partly generational, but it's partly also how people think of the fabric of their lives.
I see Mark rolling his eyes about posting pictures of food, so.
Well, yeah. I don't take them either.
Nobody cares what you ate. I don't want to see a picture of it. I'll give you a couple examples in my life of how the phones and the media are this kind of almost selfish, narcissistic thing where they can't live their lives. Example, I went to a concert last night with my wife, and we were up in the rafters, up in the cheap seats, so I had a view like of the whole auditorium. And you see this at any concert, but I just lived this 12 hours ago or so. But anyway, the people are up there singing. You've paid, you know, up to $100, and like I could look across, and at any given time, I'd say there were at least 30 cell phone lights I could see down in the audience. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, could you maybe not check your text messages so you can watch the $100 concert that you just paid for? And then you see the people who are like holding up their phones and filming the concert. And I'm thinking to myself, you're like 200 feet from the stage. Like, no one's going to watch this. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're going to post it on your Facebook page? No one, you know what I mean? Like, what is the compulsion that you have to film this crap and all that no one's going to watch, you're not going to watch again, and you're putting a barrier between yourself and what you're supposed to be enjoying? On the weekends, I work at a local hotel and banquets, so many, many, many weddings I have to work as, you know, a waiter. And I see this almost every single week. There's the reception, people get up to dance, and there's inevitably always going to be, I'm sorry, I got to get gender specific, but there's always going to be one young girl and a couple of them who will get out on the dance floor. And I watch this in amazement, to be honest with you, that they'll take out their cell phones and they're oftentimes dancing alone and they're like holding their phone out and looking in it. And I'm not kidding. Like they're doing it like for 8 minutes. And I just kind of watch on the sidelines and think, what is going on? Like, are you looking at yourself in your phone? Like, get over yourself. Do you think anyone is going to want to watch your shaky handheld video of you dancing at your sister's wedding for 10? Do you know what I'm saying? So I really want to walk up to these kids, but I can't because I'm on the clock and go, can you logically, rationally tell me what you were doing and why? Yeah, I'm not being mean. I'm just saying, like, I don't understand. What?
Well, I'd be interested in what Eric has to say about the so-called notion of life envy. Well, yeah. In other words, I'm leading my best life. I want to make everyone else envious of my life, that kind of thing.
I'm not envious of it.
Like, well, no, you're obviously you're not.
He just loves this stuff so much.
Yeah. So this is really one of the things that's come up for, very substantial discussion regarding social media, which is, everybody posts themselves and part of it is, I think, this desire to be a creator of your existence. And I don't want to get too philosophical about it or anything, but clearly people create stories and show stories and take selfies everywhere in the world. And I never got the part of the selfie part. I have to say I'm pretty terrible at that. I don't do it. But people really thrive, and the more you travel around the world, you see people taking selfies as you are there. I remember the old Walter Cronkite show from a long time ago, and the idea that you're somehow embedded in this real life. And so I think there's part of that, but the idea of switching that off is also a different way of focusing on oneself. So I think it's possible to say that it isn't so much focusing on oneself as good or not good, but rather how do you do it and what do you get out of it? Because I think clearly, in a way, it's to say, I don't have to be tethered to this world. I can create a world in the space in which I stand, and really removing myself from this virtual world.
Before we get to your phone calls, there's some pushback from a listener for Mark.
Thank you.
You're
glad to be the first one to raise a hackle in the public.
Right. She says, that's not fair, your comments about who cares about what some of these people are posting on social media. And she says, those kids have friends who do care about those posts and post similar things. When it comes down to it, maybe you're not their audience, so you disagree.
Those kids need to get a life. Sorry. I'm the cranky old man on the panel. I don't mind taking that role. So yeah, really. Sorry.
Well, but I think this is one of the let me take some exception to it. That's the perspective of someone who grew up in a certain generation with a certain view of the world.
Yep.
And the boundaries or the shape of the space that we occupy may be very different depending on those generations. And while I don't identify with the approach, I've certainly had a lot of interactions with people who find real value in this, even though it's hard for me to, be empathic about that.
Yeah.
So let me frame it a different way, Mark. I know you have a daughter who's a millennial. Mm-hmm. Are you ever trying to look at her social media posts to see what she's up to or she's interested
in? Well, I'm not on social media, so I can't look at her posts.
Do you use a fake account like my dad does?
I'm not about to spy on her. Audrey, I'm not spying on your phone. I want that said in the airwaves. Yeah, no, I don't want to get into... Yeah, look, we've raised her. She's a good girl, so, and my son also, so I assume they're not out there bullying people and doing crazy stuff. And for myself, when you hear... Because I see other people show me other people's Facebook accounts and sometimes my students and coworkers, and I don't want to know every harebrained idea that goes through your head and you decide to post all those ideas on Facebook, all your opinions, because you're going to live to regret 90% of all that crap, So that's just me. I'm sorry. I don't understand the lingo and the terms. About 5 years ago, I was at a party. I was talking to this guy, and afterwards he said, I'd like to friend you. And I thought that was a prison term, and it was just kind of awkward and uncomfortable. And I just walked away. Anyway, I'll be leaving the panel now.
Well, we are going to take our short break, and once we come back from that break, we'll get to some of our calls. So Barb and Linda, hang on the line just for a few more minutes. Before we do make that change and Mark leaves the studio for good, here's a comment from Sheila on Twitter. She's a teacher. She says, I'm heartened to see many of my students going to flip phones during the school year. Many of them cite privacy and harassment issues with social media. So that's something else we can talk about, privacy, of course, something Dr. Kane mentioned. And here's Jackie on Twitter. She says, what does it mean that I'm streaming connections through my smartphone right now? I would like to make it clear, we're not hating on smartphones this hour. We're just talking about why more people are moving to featureless phones and if that trend will continue. My guests are Mark Sample, a self-identified featureless phone user, Caitlin White, my colleague at WXXI, who's considering going back to a smartphone or a flip phone. Mm-hmm. She's the host of Weekend Edition here. Dr. Eric Kane from the University of Rochester.
An XXI app user all the time.
Thank you. And Mike Johansson, professor of senior lecturer of communication at RIT. We'll take our short break when we come back. Your phone calls. More connections next. Coming up in our second hour, a couple questions. Why do so few people vote? And how can we change or improve access to voting? Last week in primaries across the country, a very small percentage of voters decided to participate. That's especially true here in New York. So what needs to change about our state's voting rules so more people can have access to the polls? We'll talk about early voting, poll locations, civics education, and more. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. During our short break, Mark Sample has purchased a smartphone, so we will be talking about his experience during the hour. No, I'm very kidding. He's a self-identified featureless phone user and proud of it. But we are talking about people who have decided to make the switch from smartphones to featureless phones, and we'll take your phone calls next. Up first is Linda in Geneseo. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I've never had a smartphone. And what's funny, the whole discussion just kind of tickles my funny bone because the whole idea of whether people have an attitude towards it or not, like I've had people chide me for not having a smartphone. Like, why would you stick with that? Why won't you upgrade? Sort of because everything I want is right here. I don't really need it. And it finds that I have to defend it. But I'm not, like, touting it. And so that's another funny part of the conversation. Here's people who are touting that they don't have it. Like, really, it's just kind of what works for you, right? And when I watch people who have smartphones, as most everybody does, they're messing with an app or they're trying to fix an autocorrect that went wrong or something's not working there's so much fussing, you know, with it. I think the biggest benefit, it seems to me, is they take great pictures. You know, my camera does not take as good pictures as people's smartphones, and neither does the little flip phone that I have. And just to add, the funny thing that I find that's happening is my old flip phone, which really was a little flip-up thing where you had to push each button to get each letter, you know, texting took forever, that passed on to my husband, and I upgraded to the little slide thing where I have a keyboard I can use with my thumbs, and that was just a miracle to me. So I'm sort of on him to, like, why didn't you get a little keyboard? It really does work better. And he's like, so he's adamantly staying with his thing and I'm adamantly staying with mine. But I just kind of don't get it. And just the last thing, if you don't mind, I take another moment, is the discussion about, like, what are these kids doing? And I don't get it. And I mean, I work at a university and I've worked in universities for 36 years now. And I watch these students and I've seen the whole thing unfold. And I don't pretend to understand why anybody does anything. And the fact of even asking the question, like, well, they need to get a life or they need to do this, I just think that's the wrong question. I think it's sort of, you know, just as when somebody talks about racism or privilege or things that I as a white person have not experienced, and I just kind of respectfully go, I don't get it, and I, you know, we'll try to learn. I don't understand how kids work and why they do the things they do with this technology, and I think that's a lot of sociological study and psychological stuff that has to happen, but I think it's crazy, but I don't do it, and I pass no judgment. It's just not my thing. So, sorry, a little long-winded, but that's where I'm coming from.
Thank you, Linda. Thanks for calling. I'll turn to Dr. Kane for some thoughts on that. When we're thinking about, excuse me, Linda's last comment, how do you take that in terms of a research perspective?
Well, I think she said something else at the very beginning I want to touch on, which was the idea that when you're with people, they may be always looking at the phone. So one of the really big questions is, does the phone come between and separate, or does the phone serve to link and build?
Enhance.
And of course, one of the modern things, not exactly here, is you go to a doctor's office, and sometimes the doctor will be on the computer, and you have a hard time even seeing the doctor's face because they're sitting at the desk with the computer, behind the computer, as opposed to putting the computer aside and actually making a connection. So if the phone can make a connection, and we understand that sociologically or psychologically is one thing. If the phone becomes a barrier, it's another thing. And then if the phone becomes an obsession, it's a third thing. And, you know, we really need to sort those things out. And obviously, we're making big generalizations, and it's really different, going to be different with different people. And I think really, Caitlin represents the, I really want to understand what the phone means to me and how I use it type discussion. And I think that's we should do that with all the things in our lives. They shouldn't be automatic. They should be, as the current jargon is, mindful. And, you know, maybe we're talking about mindful use of smartphones as opposed to mindful use of featureless phones.
We only have a few minutes left with Mike Johansson. So before he has to pop out, I want to talk to him a little bit about boundaries. So, and this is something that Dr. Cain has referenced. Who is responsible for making changes on their phones, whether it's turning off an app, deleting an app, blocking an app like Caitlin has done, or should we be putting more pressure on companies that are doing a lot of behavioral research about how to get people to stay on their phones and scroll through infinite feeds? Do you agree with what Apple has done with the Screen Time app? Should we see more of that, or should the onus really be on ourselves? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a little bit of sort of chicken and egg, or, you know, six of one, half a dozen the other, whichever way analogy you'd like to use. I mean, honestly, I think it needs to come from us. But that, to Caitlin's point, you know, she grew up with us, you know, living life partially on Facebook. And so it's an ingrained part of her life. I have a daughter who's 25, and for her it's the same way. And I don't hold that against people. I'm just always sort of advocating that you shouldn't let that, to Eric's point, you shouldn't let that get in the way of your IRL, in real life, experience. And I've seen where that does happen. On a recent trip back to New Zealand, a sort of family gathering, and I think everyone in the room who was under 25 was on their phone all at the same time while my dad was cutting his cake for his 80th birthday. They all wanted to get a picture of it. They all wanted to but they were actually missing what he was saying because they were so focused on getting the picture, and which I think was a little unfortunate. So there were lots of good pictures, and there was a little video, and maybe some of the video was instructional later on, but they really did miss the moment because they were so busy trying to capture it. So setting boundaries, I think it starts with us. And I think the tech tools that allow us to do that be great. You know, maybe some people do need those tools, and you know, God love the people for coming up with them, but it does need to start with us.
Do you think we should be regulating tech companies? Well, in terms of some of these issues.
Yeah, so now we're getting into sort of the old Ma Bell thing, where Facebook is so prolific and so ingrained in so many people's lives that you do wonder, you know, people at Facebook have made no secret of the fact that their goal is to keep you on the platform. Mark Zuckerberg famously said in 2011, in the future there won't be an internet, there'll just be Facebook. You'll do everything on Facebook. And so that's clearly the company goal, but you know, they have to make money, and they make money by keeping eyeballs there and serving up ads and getting you to go places they want you to go. So that's their business interest. Is it at the point where it's so pervasive, and is it insidious enough? I think it is somewhat insidious. It is insidious enough that regulators need to step in. That's a question above my pay grade.
I'll ask this question to all of our panelists. A smartphone is essentially a personal computer. We're not required to carry our laptops around everywhere, be connected to them all the time, but there's this assumption that whenever we have a smartphone in our hands, we're going to be available 24/7. So, Mike, I know you got to pop out in just a few minutes. So what are your thoughts on that? Should we change the perception of smartphones? Should we not be looking at them as personal computers where you have access to email all the time, where you have access to responding in any medium that's available?
Yeah, so I sort of call that the lemming approach. And just because everyone's running towards the edge of the cliff, should I follow them? No, I think you need to be thoughtful. And I, as speaking as someone who was a journalist for 20 plus years, that's how I got hooked into phones. And originally it was a flip phone, then it started to be a phone. BlackBerry was the cool technology in the OOs. And having access to that stuff as a journalist was incredibly helpful. But it also came with a price. You started to rely on it. You started to count on it being there. You started knowing that you had access to the internet whenever you needed it. And that's when it starts to become, okay, is it taking over my life, or is it something that, you know, I need to have control over? And sort of, I made the choice one way. It's not perhaps quite so straightforward for others.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kane, what do you think?
Well, you know, this question of internal regulation versus external regulation, and the question of how do you decide to use something like this, really goes back to how do you want to live your life? And, you know, I don't want to sound greatly philosophical or existential about what do I want to be, but in part of it is, what do you want to do, and how do you want to have relationships and the like? Something like this is a wonderful tool. I mean, it can be very, very useful. And it can connect people who otherwise are disconnected, even to friends and family and that sort of thing around the world. And it's really amazing when you have the ability to connect around the world and text or call or send email. And that's just super. On the other hand, if it becomes that obsession that I'm so glued to this and all the dopamine in my body drains away when I can't get at it. As it were, I've got to have another addiction shot in order to rev it up again. Well, that's a problem. And, you know, we don't want people to be in that sort of situation. And obviously we worry about it developmentally because, you know, if you think about kids, you know, they start to, you know, we hope, sort of step out in the world, develop social ties, develop relationships, learn what works, learn what doesn't work. You know, and when they have this kind of tool, it suddenly can become a gusher, and they can be overwhelmed with things. And we certainly see some of the adverse consequences where kids are bombarded. You know, bullying in the playground's bad enough, as it were, and, you know, but you sort of can walk home and feel like, you know, a safe zone. But if you then turn on your social media tool, whether it's your computer or your smartphone, and you're still being bullied, then it's hard to find a space where you are safe. And so it has to be a safe tool. And this goes back to, you know, how do we find a way of regulating it? And I do think that's more personal than governmental. But on the other hand, when you realize that you can't hold your information in privacy, then it comes a point where you start to say, there has to be something to, you know, as a counterweight to organizations or companies that are so huge and so mammoth that they cut across national boundaries. So I think there's a lot of space for discussion. And while it's above my pay grade, too, it doesn't mean I won't say something because, you know, I've never worried about pay grades.
Caitlin, whose responsibility is it to enact these boundaries?
I mean, when I first kind of got into this and I spoke to Mike last week on the phone, I was immediately thinking it was technology's fault. I didn't want to blame myself or anything like that. I do think, you know, inherently the idea of being able to share yourself online isn't bad, right? You know, there are good things that come with Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that. So I think it is definitely more of a self-regulation. I think of the vacation, you know, selfies conversation we were having, and like people have been sharing vacation photos forever. That's not new, but it's the fact that that's what you're seeing all the time. And you mentioned someone friending you that you just met. And so you see the vacations of everyone you've ever met who's friended you. And so it's a little much. And so I think maybe bringing it back down, that's my newest where I am, is maybe I just need to follow the people I actually enjoy seeing.
Maybe there was some value in those old-fashioned cameras that you actually had to take the film and get developed.
The slides and stuff.
Well, it just had to go somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and think about what you were taking a picture of rather than just...
Well, it costs a lot, too.
Right,
because
you only
had, what, like 24 shots in disposable something.
Yeah. Well, you could get another roll of film, but that was before your time. Yeah.
I remember disposables.
But to me, part of when you say self-regulation, and again, I know I'm being a cranky old guy here, but like, say I've seen on some people's Facebook pages, like somebody will post, I am at the park with my kids, having a great day playing with my kids. And my response to that is, why don't you put your phone or your computer down and play with your kids? Like, no one wants to hear about you posting that you're with your kids because you're clearly not, because you're playing with your toy.
Yeah. So you're all about living in the moment. You brought up the point about concerts earlier, people attending concerts and just filming them and not enjoying them. And here's a comment from Rob. He says there were no phones allowed at the Jack White concert. It was an amazing 4 hours. He had to wander the whole venue to meet up with friends. He met and talked with strangers, new friends. People were using watches to tell what time it was. And so he says, maybe we stop calling it a phone. It's a camera, a video camera, email, texts, promoting tool, maps, directions. Mm-hmm. It's a personal computer. So
You would get arrested for like filming a concert or something in the old days. You know, if you brought the camera and it'd be like, what are you doing? And security's all over you. And
well, it was Mike's point, though, when he traveled back to New Zealand. At one time, if there was going to be a film, there was only one camera. Mm-hmm. You didn't have three or four cameras filming. You had the sort of the designated film operator or the designated photographer and who took the pictures for the family and then, you know, made copies or whatever. But again, this gets to both the potential and whether we know how to shape its use or not into the shape of our lives versus what you've brought up, which is people try to change their use because it seems like the phone or the connection's shaping their lives. Mm-hmm.
Well, back to the phones we go. Up next is Barbara in Rochester. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi. I'm so glad to talk to you. Everything you say, it's like, oh, that's a good segue. That's a good segue. I've been thinking about a lot of this stuff. When you mentioned photography just now, it just really struck me. And here I am using the word photography. Yes, I'm 52 years old. And I think about this all the time, and I've made some decisions with my phone. I remember I had a high school English teacher who used to say, he was kind of fuddy-duddy about it, but why do you bring a camera when you're out? Why don't you just put the camera down and experience the world? And it's the same thing we're talking about. Of course, that was a few years ago, but I think what I ended up doing, because I don't like knowing that something, that the internet can track my behavior, so I didn't like being on it so much. I felt like it was affecting my thought process because I was constantly going back to it. I had friends who would chide me, too, for not upgrading when I really wanted to downgrade, and I've done it twice now, and right now I have a smartphone, but I haven't bought the data plan. So it's a really great compromise because I'm able to not have access to email all the time and not have access to the internet all the time. So when I don't want to watch the news, and I'm an avid consumer of news, but carefully, and I listen to a lot of NPR, so I don't get the visuals because I don't always want the visual, but I want to know what's going on. And then there's times when I step away from it for mental health reasons, because there's a lot of crazy stuff going on that needs to get addressed, but not in every moment of one's day. So, and I do care very much about addressing it. So the compromise I've chosen, no data. I have voice, I have text, I made sure I had the calendar. It's cheaper, I'm paying half of what I used to pay. And my smartphone works on Wi-Fi, so when I do need to connect for work, because that is how I get my work, is usually through email, I go into a cafe, then I have to spend time with people, which is good for me, because I live alone. And, you know, I get that F2F, that face-to-face time, and it's just great. And I find my mind much quieter. I get mindfulness, which is the main reason why I went for this. So that works really well for me. And it just allows – I'm grateful that my workplace has worked out, has been willing to reach out to me in a couple of different ways sometimes. I still use use email for that. But so I find it a good compromise, and I worry about all of us getting a little too far too much away from talking to one another and in the ways that humans have talked to each other since we started talking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And signing. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Barbara. Thanks for sharing that. So more about control, more about setting those boundaries yourself. And I think it's interesting what she brought up about her work is reaching out to her in different ways because they know she doesn't have access to data and to her email all the time. And I have a friend who quit Facebook recently. We were just on a trip and she wanted the pictures, but all the pictures were posted on Facebook. She couldn't see them, so everyone's texting her the pictures. But there's so much in having to adapt and adjust based on personal preferences, which is not bad, but it makes everything very complicated in this discussion. We're down to our last few minutes of the program and the phones are flooded, so we're going to try to work through as many of your calls as possible. So I'll just ask you to keep it tight. We'll hear a bunch of you and then I'll turn to our guests to respond. So up next on the phones is Michelle in Rochester. Go ahead, Michelle.
Thanks for taking my call. I just in terms of setting boundaries, I think that we need to set some expectations of employers for not creating a culture of constant access. And this is particularly notable in my field of healthcare, where it's been difficult to have my employer kind of respect some boundaries for family. And the expectation is that we answer my chart messages and work on documentation. And, you know, our patients and our clinical work can come with us everywhere we go now. It's not even that I have to be tethered to a laptop. And so just getting your guests to kind of talk a little bit more about how do you set boundaries when your workplace is actually pushing it in the opposite direction.
That's a great question.
I'll take the comments off to the air.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle. That's a great question. I'll turn to Dr. Kane with that, since you're in the healthcare field. But overall, broadly, what should workplaces be doing?
It's very clear that, for instance, among the healthcare providers, there's a lot of burnout now. And part of this is really twofold. One is the electronic record turned out to be much more clumsy, cumbersome, time-consuming, and problematic than people ever thought it would. And so you have a lot of professionals who are doing documentation at home. And the other piece is this, you know, you want to create an interaction with patients, which is great, but folks want you 24/7. And it's going to be very important for providers and systems to be able to say, we got a life. Because if people don't have a life, they're not going to be a very good provider in the long run. And so dealing with burnout among professionals now is becoming a major workplace issue. Certainly at the University of Rochester Medical Center, there's a lot of attention now to this and concern that technology has overwhelmed providers. And so there's a pushback and also, I think, a leadership recognition that this has that we have to find a way of struggling with this. But it's like a tiger by the tail right now.
Mm-hmm. Mark, you want to weigh in on that? As a professor at a college, what would you like to see your institution do?
I don't really have a ton of comments on that. Here's one thing I will say, and it's kind of plain off what you said, but I'll just give my example, but not from the school part, but about having to be in 24-hour contact. So, like, I've told you that on the weekends I may wait tables or work in banquets, and what I see is, like, someone won't be, like, you know, the chef's not there or the assistant, somebody, and they'll go, oh, well, let's text them and ask them a question, and they're not even working. And my thought is, leave that person alone. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're at home. Don't bother them with that. Like, you would have survived 10 years ago figuring out your problem now. Everyone isn't, you know? And then, like, if you don't answer the text, like, well, what are you doing? We asked you about what happened, and you didn't text us in 8 minutes. Wrong.
Right. So there was always a need to be available for some people who were, I'll put it in quotes, covering for everyone.
Yeah.
But suddenly, once this capability came along, it was everyone was covering for themselves. And so there's actually a, you know, resurgence of how do we organize this in such a way. But it's very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I still don't know where my decision will lay. I mean, we're getting close to the end, and I think definitely regulation is part of it.
Do you think it's unrealistic that we should, in terms of what Mark was saying, expect people not to reach out if you're not on the clock, you're not working? I texted you when you were off.
Yeah.
And I expected
and
you
I didn't
to
respond.
Back.
To
no, you
it.
Didn't. You responded to my first one, then not my second. And I thought, this is your day off. I shouldn't be bothering you. So, but is it easier said than done, Caitlin?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've gotten to this point where we kind of are all, you know, I told you you could text me because I just kind of assumed I should always be available also. So, you know, that's maybe something I shouldn't have said if I had more, if I wanted to actually not be talked to for those 2 days. But it is, you know, it is hard when a lot of, especially what we do, is on all the time. So, you know, it's definitely genre or career driven, but it'd be great if it never happened, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
We're getting down to our last few minutes, so I'll just read a few of the comments that we have from listeners who are on the line. Bonnie says that there are side effects of this issue on society. There are fewer public phones, fewer clocks, so because people are carrying around their devices. So for people who don't have smartphones or don't have access to any kind of cell phone, that's tough for them. So definitely challenges that we should talk about on a future program. Andrew says, Andrew in Brighton, no phone, no computer. People are realizing he's right now. So it looks like he's made the switch. And against my better judgment, I'm going to take one more call. This is Joel in Rochester. Joel, we got to be real quick.
I wanted to just say that I'm in the park every day, and I see people walking side by side, oftentimes with children and dogs. and they're oftentimes on separate phones. And so at some point, you've got to realize that it doesn't seem like these folks care about their children or their animals, and we should be putting more of an emphasis on being present. And that seems to be something that's difficult for a lot of people to do. So that's my comment.
Thanks, Joel. I think that's a good way to summarize a lot of the comments that we've heard on the program this hour. So even if you are a smartphone user and have no plans to make any changes, there are things that we can do if you feel like you're not being present. And I also want to mention a new study in the journal Sleep that was recently released, because it's something that I think we should have you back to talk about, Dr. Kane. The research says that smart devices and screen time lead to insomnia, poor sleep quality, and depression among adolescents, especially teenagers. We're seeing the suicide rates among teenagers rise. I was talking to a young woman recently who said she got off social media because she was concerned about body image issues and she had suicidal ideation. So as you were talking about bullying, there are certainly side effects that have some really serious consequences to them, and that's worth another hour on the program as well.
Of course.
So, listeners, thank you for all of your feedback. We couldn't get to a lot of it. I appreciate you calling in, no matter what device you were calling on. Maybe it was a landline. But our thanks to our guests as well, Mark Sample, my colleague Caitlin White, Dr. Eric Kane, and earlier Mike Johansson, a senior lecturer of communication at RIT. Short break, more Connections next.